From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. I am Paul Edwards in Miami, Florida, and welcome to Tuesday Topics. Let me begin by expressing my appreciation to our erstwhile recorder editor, Steve Bauer, who makes our programs possible every week by the wonderful work that he does, not only in capturing our programs, but also in editing them and then getting them in a condition where they can be broadcast the next week. Let me also thank my producer, Mr. Brian Charlson, who pinch hit for me last week and who this week helped pull together the group of folks who we have to discuss our topic this evening. And of course, I'd like to begin as well by expressing my appreciation to George Byes of Talking Communities, without whose software this program would not be. Tonight on Tuesday Topics, we're going to be discussing a couple of blogs that have appeared on a blog site that many of you may have had an opportunity to look at, but if not, it's at www.carroll.org, carroll.org. And this is the Carroll Center for the Blind website. And among other things, it has on it a series of blogs that have been appearing for the last several months. And many of the initial points of these blogs are written by our primary guest this evening, Mr. Bob Hache. And Bob, in writing blogs, has written two in particular that will capture our attention tonight. One is on a new piece of legislation that was led by a senator from Massachusetts, Representative Markey, and the other concerned universal design. So let me ask Bob if he would tell us a little bit about what prompted him to start blogging, perhaps, and then maybe he could tell us a bit about the Markey blog and some of the issues that it raises.
Okay, Paul. First of all, thank you for having me on Tuesday Topics this week. It is certainly my pleasure to be here. I've been looking for work now for a while, since last fall, and in the middle of that process, somewhere in late January, I started discussing with Brian Charlson the idea that the Carroll Center had gotten some sort of funding to go ahead and produce blogs, and he asked me how I might feel about trying my hand at blogging. And I've done a good bit of writing, particularly advocacy type writing, such as budget hearings and things like that, but I've never actually gotten paid to do an all writing job like this, so it's been rather interesting, you know, improving my web researching skills and whatnot. And the bulk of the blogs so far have been around technology. I've done ones, for example, on the new PacMate Omni, and when the Victor Stream got the RFB&D capability. And then we started to sort of broaden our horizons, and we started to do things like the blindness, the Fairness Earnings Act and Social Security. And then, of course, there was the one on the Markey bill, which to me is one of the, you know, obviously, it's one of our legislative priorities here, you know, for ACB for this year. And also, Rep. Ed Markey happens to be my representative, and I must say that that is, a bit of a source of pride for me. And I was happy to see that Markey, along with the COAT group, which is the Coalition for Accessible Technology, has decided to put forth a much more broad-based legislative initiative when compared with the previous one that Markey did, which would have restored the mandates around video description that were in play before the horrible court decision of, I believe it was 2002, that struck them down. This bill is, and I've actually spoken, interestingly enough, with members of the NFB of Massachusetts about this particular bill, and even though it has the mandates for video description in it, they had no problem supporting it because of all of the other things that it would do, which, among other things, is improve accessibility for cell phones, voice over internet protocol phones, things like cable boxes, satellite boxes, DVR boxes, and also things like DVD players. I mean, you just think, wouldn't it be neat to open up the box of your new DVD player or digital recorder and to be able to push a button and have the thing start talking for you, all the information that comes on that menu screen. And so the first of the blogs on universal design, which I ended up referring back to, came about as a result of AT&T's announcement on universal design, and I started sort of talking about, I felt a bit like Martin Luther King Jr. with his I Have a Dream thing, but I thought it was sort of a good theme because, you know, my dream, and I think a lot of our dreams of accessible, of universal design, mean that we can go out and buy any one of, you know, whether we're talking about TVs, microwaves, you know, video recorders, or, you know, even a toaster oven or a coffee maker. If you could, A, get an accessible user guide for the thing, and then, B, even better, get that thing to talk its way through all of its functions in the same way that it displays the information on a video screen. And so that just really sort of, and then the article in the Boston Globe that's referenced at the bottom of the recent blog on the Markey bill sort of, you know, started to get me going. And I had been thinking about doing something with video description, and then I decided to sort of broaden it out to include the whole bill. And I did have a chance to listen to the hearing referenced in the blog, and any of you out there, if you haven't had a chance to get to listen to the hearing, I strongly encourage you to go and check out that hearing. It's a very powerful hearing. It's 2 hours long, but I would believe that it's 2 hours well spent.
Just for fun, do you remember the web address of the hearing so that we could give it to our listeners so they could go there, or should they just go and grab it from your blog?
They can grab it from my blog. Unfortunately, I think it's one of these superly-duperly long ones.
Folks can get it from your blog, and then they can just save it, especially if it's one of these nice long ones. And I'll echo the warning that you give in your blog, and that is there is a period of silence before the hearing actually gets gaveled into existence. So be prepared for that period of silence at the beginning, and don't think that you haven't gotten anywhere because that happens. Let's talk for a minute, if we could, about the term that you used in your earlier blog, and that term is universal design. There are some of us who sort of feel that universal design is a term that's gotten overused and is sometimes not very well defined, and often has been used by people to mean things that perhaps it doesn't. So maybe you could tell us what you mean by universal design.
That's a good question, Paul. I certainly will admit that I am looking at universal design probably much more from an advocate's point of view as opposed to maybe an engineer's or a technologist's point of view. And my concept of universal design is a concept whereby, you know, all of the devices that get produced in a genre, that is, all microwaves, all coffee makers, or all of any of these devices, must, at a minimum, be able to display or show by non-visual means all of the elements that are portrayed on some sort of a digital screen. And really, to a large extent, that means that the things would talk. For example, your microwave would be able to talk when you turn it on. It would read you what's on the screen by the push of a button, or perhaps automatically if you were to set it up that way. And the same would go for a cell phone, you know, a computer, or any of these devices that have a screen that displays. I mean, much like, you know, you go up to these talking ATM machines and you put your earplug into the thing and it starts jabbering away, And, you know, and then you just go on through your transactions. And I must say that in the process of using those, I've had people sort of come up to me with curiosity and wondering, you know, how do you know how to do that? Or sometimes they'll notice that I've put an earplug in. Boy, I never knew there was an earplug there. And what does that do? And, you know, I've actually showed them, you know, after I'm done with my transaction, I've let people use it for their transactions so they could check it out, and they thought it was pretty cool. And so I certainly don't know if that is the proper definition for universal design, but that's sort of the definition that I've, I guess, latched onto, you know, not only in this blog, but in other contexts as well.
I was intrigued by the fact that you felt that universal design would actually be represented by telephones that would allow a program like Tox, for example, to be used, and that would constitute universal design. Do you believe that?
Well, not really. I mean, ideally, universal design would mean that you wouldn't need a program like Tox. I know that the mobile speaks was referenced in, and that's very interesting that you mentioned that, because AT&T claims to be a champion of universal design, yet it doesn't, you know, my argument would say if they were truly thinking that this stuff was universal design, they would offer these programs for free. Or either that, or maybe it wouldn't need them because the thing would inherently be able to talk without such an add-on. But, you know, you take what you can get, I guess, and you are right that certainly is not, at least it's not my idea of universal design. It might be the idea of people who are interested in corporate profits. It might be their idea of universal design because, of course, then there would be money to be made on such a product.
Yeah, I find it kind of interesting that sometimes, and I guess that's really what I meant earlier when I said that we sort of muddy the design, certainly in the hearings that you reference, it was interesting to me that some of the industry people spoke of universal design at the same time as they were touting products like the NFB reader built into a cell phone. And for me, it's not only not universal design, but it also requires that in order to get the same kind of access that others have, blind people have to pay a pretty substantial tariff, which for me isn't universal design, because I think one of the other criteria that we need to accept as a core value in universal design is you don't have to pay extra for the same accessibility that everybody else expects as a matter of course from the product that they buy for a relatively modest sum. And so for me, anyway, a program that relies on Tox or MobileSpeak in order to get its accessibility is not a product that meets my definition of universal design. Let's return to your later blog for a minute about the Markey bill. And you not only provide information about the Markey bill, but you also provide some very current and pertinent information on the current state of video description or audio description, whichever you want to call it. Bring us up to date on what the current state of that game is, if you would.
Okay, well, basically, one of the first points I made in the second section of that blog is to sort of talk about what's happening with WGBH and its sale of described videos, which, of course, have been done with VHS tapes. My understanding is that those tapes are no longer available, and that May 12th was the last date on which those were available. They were offering for a week or two some deep discounts, I believe, on what was left of their collection. And it just, you know, it strikes me that as once again, as I mentioned earlier to you, Paul, as we move ahead technologically from the age of the VHS tape to be used in VCRs to the DVD, and now they've got the Blu-ray DVD, I believe the newer one is called, that you find that in terms of described video, we're taking a step backward because there's such a small amount of available material available on DVDs that are described. As a matter of fact, the bulk of the available DVDs with description happen to have been produced by the public broadcasting system. There are things like the American Experience, Abraham Lincoln, and I think the one on baseball that Ken Burns did, I believe, was described, although I don't know. I didn't remember seeing that one on the list of available ones that they had there. And so that certainly is a big issue. And it's certainly ironic that as we have more, theaters that have these rear window captioning and description systems using infrared in the headsets, that these tracks just aren't making their ways onto DVDs. And, our treasurer here in Massachusetts thinks that it's a bunch of hogwash, that there isn't enough room on the discs for the description. I'm not sure what the case is, but if that is the case, as I said in the blog, I don't see why they shouldn't be able to produce either one set for everybody or maybe a special set, and maybe that's not universal design because you might have to pay an extra buck or two for that second disc. But quite frankly, I'd rather have that option available and be able to get that movie with description than to have a situation where you can't get it at all. And then, you see, if you had the portions of the bill that say that these devices need to be accessible, then you wouldn't need the system called audio navigation that exists on some of the discs that are out now. And I'm pretty sure that the audio navigation does actually take up a considerable room on the disc. And for those of you that don't know, audio navigation is a system whereby it allows the menus to talk. You can move up and down, arrow left and right, and listen to your selections and push the OK button and use a menu just like a sighted person would do. It would be nice if the devices did that on their own without prompting from software that might exist on a particular CD. And just to let everybody know, there is only one disc that I know of that is a regular commercial movie that has both description and audio navigation, and it is the Grinch that came out, I believe, in 2001 or so.
Yep, and just to reinforce what you said, the fascinating thing is, for the first time, movie companies are actually paying for the production of described tracks in, I don't know that it's huge numbers of movies, but probably at least 5 or 6 or 7 movies a month anyway, which would add up to about 80 movies a year that would at least, in theory, be very easily made available for purchase if these tracks actually made it onto DVDs. But very, very few DVDs have actually ended up containing tracks that incorporate description. I think that was a good point. And I think the other thing that you mentioned in your blog, which is another point that's worth making, is part of the reason that WGBH went out of the business is that the movie manufacturers themselves are ceasing to produce movies on VHS tape, which means that it's going to be virtually impossible for WGBH to add their description to existing VHS tapes, and it becomes an entirely different issue taking something mass-produced and adding a descriptive track to it and then starting from scratch and producing VHS tapes and the masters and the whole nine yards from the top down. So it's an interesting state of affairs. You also talk a little bit about some of the provisions in the law that relate to satellites and cable. What's the problem there?
Okay, basically it's, it's just like the DVD players that I was mentioning before. You can't use these things, and if you think about the modes of video technology that we all used, for those of us that are old enough, 30 years ago or so, you'd go and you'd get yourself a new TV or a new VCR. Maybe you'd bring it home and you get a volunteer or friend or family member to read you a few of the basics of the user guide, and, you know, you're pretty much up and running based on that. And, you know, you were pretty much good to go. Nowadays, a lot of these things have, and just to, so that for people don't know, for example, the older ones before the days of remote controls actually had a click between the channels so that you could feel the clicks of the knobs that you would turn. Everything was knobs and buttons. And even the first remote control TVs were a little bit of a problem, but they weren't so bad because they didn't have very many of these on-screen menus. Now, all of these devices have on-screen menus that you buy, whether it's a new TV or a new DVD player or what have you. And then what happens with the, you know, some of these cable companies have some really neat features. For example, the ability to digitally record programs that are happening so that you can watch them when you want to and zap the commercials and all that good stuff. Now, you got to be able to see in order to use that. I can do a limited amount with it by memorization of commands. For example, if I know that a program is first on the list, I can do two commands that will get that to play. If I know that it's second on the list, I can go down to that one and play that one as well. And then when it ends, I can hit the OK button, which I know will delete it. And I know that because my sighted wife has painstakingly gone over this with me and read the screens to me. Now, they did change the setup of this thing one day, and I think I tried to watch one of the debates between gubernatorial candidates back in our last governor's race. And I was unable to watch the show when I wanted to because the steps had changed. And when my wife let me know what the new set of steps was, I was then able to use it. As far as recording programs, I can record something if I put it on at the beginning of the program and hit one button. Of course, I can't confirm that it's being recorded. As for setting things up in advance, there's no way you could memorize all of the steps necessary to do that. The other thing that cable companies offer, which is pretty neat nowadays, is guides whereby you can search through the listings of programs up to either 4 days or a week in advance. That stuff is all completely menu-driven and completely inaccessible currently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a problem. And the other area that it's that is absolutely out of bounds is an area that some cable companies call on-demand. And others relate to, for instance, downloading a pay-per-view movie. Those are available in cable listings as on-demand, and in satellite, they actually show up as particular channels that that you can click on and make arrangements to download. So the problem is screen menus, but the problem is also, at least to some extent, the equipment that's being used as well. Now, does the date February 2009 mean anything to you, Mr. Hache?
Yeah, that's the date that all of us who don't either have digital cable boxes or digital TVs will come home and look forward to the wonders of white noise when analog TV will no longer function. Should be interesting. Certainly for those who are receiving video description, while on a cable box it might not be any different, although that's already very inaccessible. I had my wife learn from good friends of ours last night exactly how to make the SAP channel come in, and it wasn't clear to either one of us how to make that work, and we were afraid if we did it, we would end up with a screen full of Spanish and wouldn't be able to get back to the English. But that's another story. Yes, the conversion to digital TV is something that is really going to, while it may not affect those of us who use cable and satellite so much, will really very strongly impact particularly those who are at the poorer end of the income spectrum. I don't know what the percentage of households is nowadays that don't have cable. Obviously, if you're in a rural area, you may not have cable because in some rural areas they still don't have it. And so that if you don't have cable or satellite, and you don't go out and get one of these, either a converter box or a TV, you will need to find something else to do with your time, which in some respects might not be a totally bad thing, but you might not have planned for it, and if you're not expecting it, it would be a change people won't like.
The other issue that surrounds the conversion that's going to happen is all of our little portable TV radios will no longer be TV radios. They will just be radios, which is sort of sad. But it's one of the things that currently is going away, and who knows whether there's even a way to produce digital TV radios easily, and whether anybody will even consider the idea of producing a digital TV radio. It'll be an interesting question to ask. But I think the other issue that's still somewhat up in the air, at least insofar as I know, is exactly how video description will happen after the conversion to digital occurs, because at least at the moment I haven't seen any final and absolute commitment to making specific bandwidth available for description. Does anybody who's on here at the moment know anything more about that?
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you are listening to Tuesday Topics. If you have comments about the show or a suggestion of a topic you would like to have discussed, send a message to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Once again, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
We can start to open things up so that we can broaden our discussion. So I know there are some others from Boston. Do any of you other guys from Boston have more current information on the fate of video description on TV, a la the conversion?
This is Brian from Boston, and a couple of things here. One is that if you get a chance to go to the ACB convention, and they very well may record it as one of the breakout sessions that they take the transmission equipment off to on ACB radio for its live broadcast of the convention. The Information Access Committee is going to be reviewing three or four of these box converters for those who have analog televisions and analog reception, who want to be able to still access things through this digital converter. And it's our understanding through friends at WGBH that at least two of them are capable of passing through the audio description component. Because they've tested it and they know that it will pass through the audio description channel, so to speak, one can assume that there is at least temporarily an established bandwidth for that purpose. I'm not sure that there's something within the regulations or whether it's right now simply a matter of they haven't figured out what to do with all that bandwidth in the first place, so they're not struggling to hold on to every possible gigabyte of bandwidth. But nonetheless, if you're interested in the whole issue of the digital converter boxes that will be available, you will be able to get your hands on one to take a look at that and get a demonstration at the Access Committee presentations at the ACB convention.
Thank you, Brian. Let's kind of open it up. Bob and I talked earlier about the idea of universal design. Do others who are here kind of, let me ask the question rather than trying to make people come down on one side or the other. Should products like Tox and MobileSpeak be spoken of in the same breath as you talk about universal design?
Absolutely not. This is Dave McElroy in Visalia, California, and let me explain why. Because at this point, they are not part of universal design. They are strictly programs for one specific purpose, to make a telephone more accessible to the blind. And you have to be willing to pay a lot of money for it. I don't happen to be interested in doing that, so when I think of universal design, and yes, I believe that we should all work toward universal design, I believe in something that everyone can use. I, for example, would submit to you that the accessible pedestrian signal is actually a truly universal design because it simply adds to what's already there. It adds a visual and tactile cues to the audible and tactile cues to the visual that are already there. That, to me, renders it universal design. If we could convince the world at large that to provide universal design would, in fact, contribute to the ease of use for everyone, not just for blind people, but for everyone, then I think we would have a sale of Universal Design. Right now, we're not marketing it that way. We're marketing it strictly toward blindness, and I think we're going the wrong way. We need to go to, you know, the world at large. That we need design that everyone can use. I mean, look at the probably the best example of that is all the curb cuts that we all know and love. Some of them aren't real friendly to us, but generally speaking, everybody loves them because they can push their baby carriages and their shopping carts up and down the cuts. This is where we have horribly, horribly failed over time.
Let's take a couple of your issues. Would others class the two instances that that Dave has raised, that is, accessible pedestrian signals and curb cuts, as examples of universal design or not?
This is Mika Paikla, and yes, I would say that those two items would be universal design. I've thought of it also recently, even in terms of the proliferation of plastic cards. The other day I was trying to find my Dunkin' Donuts card, and they're all smooth with no tactile differentiation now. Or even something like a hotel card to get into your room. In the past, at least, you might have been able to feel the magnetic strip, but now they're making them so that there's no tactile differentiation with these cards. So I would say that that's another, you know, it could even be something like that. As far as Paul's original question about the cell phones, I mean, I'm more comfortable saying that something like Tox would represent universal design, but I would be concerned in the event that it didn't do everything that the phone did. There could certainly be lapses. So just the quality of an adjunct product, and the cost is certainly an issue. I don't know if that would fall under universal design or if it would fall under something else. I agree that the technology should be affordable and available to people, but I don't know that I necessarily considered that part of universal design, but I definitely see the issue being raised, you know, what the nature of that issue is, especially with our community.
Brian here once again. I use an LG 8350 phone, which has voice navigation in it. Allows me to use the keys and navigate through much of what's available on the phone, but not all of what's available on the phone. I knew that at the time I purchased it, but it's my personal opinion that I ought not to be forced to buy a higher-end phone than my service plan requires or provides free of charge or at a large discount, only because I have to get that phone or I won't be able to access features of the service. I also think that requiring that I purchase a third-party product or even pay for most of the cost of a third-party product, like the AT&T offer, is flying in the face of the concept of universal design. To me, universal design says that every manufacturer of every consumer product does the design of their product with an intent to reach the widest market, not down the center of the road where they'll get most people with the least effort, but rather design with all of the little niche communities involved in the process of determining feature sets and the like, and that they do so in a way that does not cause individuals to have to pay for their accessibility as a surcharge on top of what they're already paying for the core service. An example of that would be the captioning chips that are now included in all televisions over a certain size in the United States. By requiring that all manufacturers include a captioning chip within them, it raised the price of a television by about a nickel. It was in everybody's television, and everybody could take advantage of it. And certainly sighted members of my household use captioning as a way to watch television, so to speak, without disturbing other members of the household doing things like listening to music or a baseball game on the radio at the same time. So to me, universal design needs to speak to the issue of when you should be expected to have to pay extra for something, when the only thing you gain through that extra charge is access to the same thing that others are not having to pay an extra charge for.
Bob, did you want to jump in on this issue?
I think I saw an e-text post that his headset isn't functioning. So if he participates, he's going to need to use the text chat window, as he did when he announced that his headset was no longer functioning.
I agree with you, Brian, incidentally, that would, what you spoke of, would kind of be the ideal or the gold standard of where we need to be. But unfortunately, it seems like we're so far, you know, away from that. I hope we can get to that, but it just seems like that standard is so far away from where we are, especially the blind community relative to, as you mentioned, even the deaf.
This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. A lot of things, if you talk about universal design, I don't know how far, I hope it's not far afield, but things for the blind are more expensive than things for sighted people, because they say, you hear the statement that there's not that many of us there, which I guess is true, but then, you know, as far as talking elements in areas like cell phones and things, I mean, a sighted person can't really see all the time. Like, if a person drives a car, they should be using hands-free products and things of that nature, and it seems like that in itself should bring the price of some of the accessible products to us down a notch or two.
Yeah, I agree with that, Gary, as well, and with what Brian has said. I think the problem is, and you know, I don't like to malign anybody or any group, but while we in ACB are sitting there, you know, clapping ourselves on the back, we're walking backwards. We've been walking backwards in the technology field, truly, if you want to get down to it, from about the early 1990s. We've sort of caught up in some ways and then stepped back and sort of caught up and stepped back. But basically, we're going backwards, not forward. This is where the National Federation of the Blind, in their old stuff in the 1960s and 70s, I think they were probably quite right that blindness was a mere inconvenience. That was a time when you could pick up a phone and dial it and get your call through. You could basically depend on a lot of dialogue from TV to kind of guess at what was going on and do a fairly creditable job at it. Cars were noisy enough that you really didn't have to worry too much about a silent vehicle bearing down on you without you even knowing it. And you could turn a radio dial, or a TV station dial for that matter, and have a reasonable expectation of getting to where you wanted to be. These are the things, they're little things, but we're losing ground every day. How many, you know, digital pieces of digital equipment does every one of us have in our own homes that we really can't use or can't use for? Right now I'm in a quandary myself, because our old CD players are going bad, and so, you know, and we have to go down and find out, well, so do we get a DVD player? And if so, how do we use it? These are the ways that we're actually sliding. And I don't know what to do about it, but we surely need to be doing something that we're not.
Thanks. Let me catch some folks up with a couple of text messages. Bob actually responded to my question, and he kind of indicated that he agrees with what most people have said about universal design, but he feels that what we actually need are stronger laws, that we aren't going to get anywhere in terms of persuading manufacturers to adopt the idea of universal design until and unless we operate with stronger laws. I certainly think that if you go and listen to the Markey hearings, you'll get some intimations that that's probably true, because some of the industry reps who are there certainly have some interesting things to say, and would clearly like folks to believe that they take the idea of universal design seriously, and that in fact they have lots of products that are out there which represent universal design, like the NFB reader. I want to go back to our definition of universal design and to Dave McElroy's examples for a moment, I would like to posit the idea that for different reasons, neither of the products that Dave discussed are viewed as examples of universal design. Let's take the curb cuts first. Curb cuts aren't regarded as elements of universal design because there are many users of wheelchairs who believe that the tactile warnings that are a core component of curb cuts as we know them are actually dangerous and make things difficult for them. They are also not regarded as elements of universal design by some blind folks who believe that the way that they are structured, that is, sloping in from the sides and often coming off at an angle, makes it extremely difficult for a blind person sometimes to cross streets if those components are actually used by blind people. To take the accessible pedestrian signal, I don't know of a single traffic engineer who would say that an accessible pedestrian signal is anything more than a special needs addition that is being made to signals for a small minority of people who probably won't use it anyway. I.e., I think we need to incorporate into our definition of universal design issues that don't simply relate to technical specifications, but also relate to acceptance. By my definition of universal design, there are actually very few products. I would agree, by the way, with Brian, that a better example of a cell phone that incorporates universal design is the phone that both he and I use, which is the LG 8350, rather than the AT&T phones with Tox, because our phones are off the shelf and they're being sold to anybody. And we don't have to make any adaptation in order to get, I would say, access to about 70 or 75% of the phone's features. So for me, they come a lot closer than the products that require us to spend extra money and that by themselves would have very little access. If you take my two examples from Dave's list, I think that for curb cuts, one of the things that they suggest we need to include is a universal acceptance of the idea that there ought to be a compromise inherent in the way we design things so that the needs of many can be met, even when the needs of the few may be made more difficult. And until that becomes a core value, if you like the greatest good for the greatest number, to use kind of the utilitarian philosophical notion from the 19th century, becomes a core value of universal design, I don't think we'll get anywhere. And I also think that until society gets to the place where it recognizes that in order for public entities to design signals, they need to meet the needs of everyone, not just some of the population, we're not going to get very far. So I think that's the other inherent component of universal design that we haven't talked about so far. Perhaps folks may want to take issue with some of the principles that I've attempted to expound here.
Well, I might as well be the first one. With respect to curb cuts, part of the difficulty of using curb cuts as an example is that it was not a single design, but rather an evolution of designs from the initial curb cut that resulted in blind people moving from the pedestrian way into the vehicular way without noticing, because they were attempting to create the most gentle slope possible to benefit those who were wheelchair users. So we then had to create our own modification of the curb cut so that we could tell when we were moving from the curb cut into the roadway, that detectable warning. That's issue number one with the example. Issue number two with the example is those blind and visually impaired folks who complain that detectable warnings are placed in curb cuts in such a way that they can't use them for determining direction are misusing the design feature. It was never designed or intended to be any kind of tool to establish direction while in a curb cut. Rounded curves, blended curves, these kinds of things. Yeah, in a perfect world where everything is nice and square, you can get away with using them for both direction finding and for indicating when you're moving from, like I said, the pedestrian way into the vehicular way. But other than that, that's a misuse of it. I think a core value of universal design is that we get as much as we can in terms of usability by the greatest number. And here, a wheelchair user who says, I don't like those detectable warnings, they make it harder for me to get up or down the curb cut. That may be true. But is that need greater than a blind person's need to know when they're going from the sidewalk to the road? And I would doubt that any blind or any blind person, or for that matter, any wheelchair-using person would say that the convenience of a wheelchair user is more important than the safety of a blind user. Now, moving on to the second one, Paul, the audible signals or accessible pedestrian signals, again, from your original description, David. When I was in Australia, I noticed that their installation of these signals were being used by sighted people all the time because they were using the ticking noise as a way to allow them to not be in constant vigil watching the walk, don't walk sign, but rather they would hold conversations facing all different directions. And the minute they heard the ticking noise, which indicates on their signals that it's okay to cross, they would stride forward and be scanning at the same time they started that walk. They were listening to the signals and adding that as a tool along with the visual signals of when it was time to cross. That, to me, is very universal. Part of it, then, has to be that we have to educate people of the value of the features. And perhaps we're not doing that as well as we should.
Well, and that's another example of something that benefits all blind people, but sighted people can enjoy the benefits of as well. But myself, I've been trained to know when to cross when the traffic starts up, if that's the way it works. But as far as curb cuts go, I learned how to use them, like back in Kalamazoo. That was the first time at the center that I've ever come in contact with blended curb or curb cuts. I was used to them, but when they first came out, the curb cut was just about the size of the wheelchair. I could notice the the curb on the right, you know, the regular curb, or on the left. But in my neighborhood, in Lansing, the curb cut is as wide as the sidewalk is, instead of just as wide as the wheelchair.
Brian, I certainly hear what you're saying in response to my stuff. What I would say about Australia, and it also applies in Europe, is the big difference is those countries have now made the inclusion of audible feedback a core value of their signals anyway. And in budgeting for the installation of signals, they would not dream of putting in new pedestrian signals that weren't usable by everyone. And so perhaps another component that we need to add is a geopolitical one. And we perhaps should suggest that in Europe and in Australia and in New Zealand and in Japan, there is a more general recognition that people who are disabled have the right to expect accommodations from their communities. That same value is not an inherent part of our political value, where everything that we do for people with disabilities is perceived by local, state, and the federal government to a degree as something extra that is tacked on and is regarded as an additional cost rather than an inherent right that ought to be incorporated simply by reason of citizenship.
Paul, this is Steve Bauer from Wichita, Kansas. I want to argue with you about the cell phone. I have the LG 8300 cell phone, and yes, it's very nice to have the menus that talk, but if they just would talk, I mean, yeah, the first level or two does. But to get down to setting some of the features such as ringers and alarms and other things, you can't do it. And therefore, I think your guesstimation of 75% of the phone's functionality is accessible is way high. I'd probably flip that and say it's about 25%. And if they had just gone ahead and finished what they started, they would have had an outstanding product. But they stopped. And they stopped because the design and all of that work was being done by people who viewed it as a novelty, not as a necessity. And until they realize that all of it needs to talk, they're missing the mark totally. And therefore, other phones with other software components added to them are the obvious choice for somebody who really wants to use the total capability of a cell phone.
Yeah, I actually can't disagree with a lot of that. We'd have to do some measurement to see what percentages are. I guess what I see is a continuum that's emerged with the LG phones. And each of their models in the series has had more accessibility built into it. The 9900 actually allows a blind person to receive and send text messages, which, and I think it's the only phone that actually allows that out of the box. And so I think I am probably less careful in my criticism, or less careful in the praise that I offer to LG, because they seem to be the only company, and Verizon seems to be the only company, that's doing very much to create phones that off the shelf have very much accessibility built into them. Most of the other companies, their phones do far less than the Verizon phones do. But I do take your point. But on the other hand, I am concerned that we don't offer very much praise in any of the stuff that comes out for Verizon's approach, which certainly includes the creation of phones that out of the box are more accessible than anybody else. Instead, they're lumped in with all the other companies as not doing very much. And so I guess that's why I err on the other side. I do want to, for just a moment, acknowledge two very long text messages from Chris Maddox. In the second one, Chris indicates that he really believes, and Chris, if I'm misunderstanding you, forgive me. Chris suggests that he actually believes that curb cuts are pretty usable and that he can actually navigate pretty effectively in spite of or as a result of curb cuts, and that he believes that they actually do represent a pretty good device that's out there. He asked an earlier question. For some reason, I can't get to my text messages at the moment, but I know, Chris, it concerned the accessibility of radio in 2009 or something like that. Chris is asking what will happen with radios in 2009 when they go digital. And the answer is that I know of no legislation that will cause radios to go digital. While there is digital radio out there that is very slowly gaining some market share, there isn't any deadline date that's been set where other radio stations will be required to go digital. So there shouldn't be any impact on radios, except on those radios that also include the TV channels. Those TV channels, the channels from 2 to 13, which many TV radios have, will no longer work. So that's my understanding of the situation.
Paul, Steve, I think you're correct. The HD radio that is being rolled out is, in my opinion, being rolled out very poorly. TV is bombarding us with the conversion almost to the point of being obnoxious. With HD radio, I think the radio stations are doing an extremely poor job in trying to explain it to John Q. Public, using phrases like the hidden stations and the stations between the stations. It's not catching on because they're not making any sense. They're not telling the listeners what it really is and how it works. So far, I've not heard of any HD-capable radios, either for your home or your car, that have any accessibility. Most of them you can run, and you can find your stations, and you can tune them in and that type of thing, but you just won't be able to take advantage of the text or the data that is displayed on the screen of the radios.
And Chris, I think the bottom line is you won't have to worry about radios. The only thing you're going to have to worry about is analog televisions or analog TV radios. Frankly, that's only going to operate in the States. So for folks in Canada, I don't even know what the situation with regard to analog and digital stuff is. But I don't think you need to be concerned at this point, Chris, with any radio issues. So at this point, we are approaching the point at which we need to wind this stuff down. I don't know that you actually can get a new TV radio at this point that will work after 2009, because I don't know of any TV radio that currently exists that will allow you to receive digital signals. I think perhaps after digital TV comes online, somebody may in fact produce one. But at this point, there isn't one available that I know of on the market. I'll open it up for other folks. Does anyone know of a digital TV radio that's available on the market at this point?
Well, I haven't heard of one exactly, but I know that they've been talking about it on some of the lists that if you have a TV radio, it probably won't work after 2009 or that period, February 17th. As far as I know, I don't think there is any alternative after 2009.
Nope, I don't think so either. I'd like to thank Bob Haché and everyone else who's been a part of our show this evening for your comments on universal design and for your discussion of some of the issues that we face with regard to emerging technology and some of the efforts that are being made by legislators to do something about that. I think that it's clear that even among ourselves, there's some disagreement about what universal design is, and indeed about how it needs to apply. So I hope that at the very least, what our program tonight has done is to start people thinking a little bit about some of the issues that we need to be raising politically in 2008 and culturally, perhaps, within our community as well. Thank you very much for being with us. And remember, if you have questions or issues, please send an email to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Thank you for being with us. Remember, even though TV radios won't work, radios will, and we have the potential of getting much more out of TV if we play our cards right. Thank you and good night.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 1 hour Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.